It's time for the Burt Cohen Show. America, yes, we are now involved in celebrating the 100th anniversary of the birth of our mythic hero, St. Ronald Reagan. You know, it's unquestionable that he lifted American spirits at a time when they needed lifting, but what was the actual effect of Ronald Reagan's presidency on this nation and on the world, for that matter? Our guest today on the Burt Cohen Show is Robert Perry. Robert, thanks for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show.
Well, thanks for having me, Burt.
Well, sure. We are very pleased to have you. Robert Perry is an American investigative journalist who has written extensively about the Iran-Contra scandal. Anybody remember that? During the 1980s, he worked for Associated Press and Newsweek and broke a number of the stories surrounding the Iran-Contra mess, I don't know what you call it, scandal, definitely. Along with his AP partner, Brian Barger, he was the first to report on Oliver North's activities in the White House basement, the first to describe the Nicaraguan Contras' involvement with cocaine traffickers. Robert Perry's latest book is Neck Deep, The Disastrous Presidency of George W. Bush. Well, again, Robert, thanks for being with us. And as we said, he restored faith in America. And as you say, Ronald Reagan is enshrined as the genial ex-actor who revived the American spirit after those trying days of the 1970s. I wonder if you could start us out by talking about that aspect of Ronald Reagan, the revival of our spirit. What did that mean for us?
Well, I think there's really no question that Reagan was a very skillful politician, particularly good at knowing what strings to pull in the American psyche. Remember, not only was he a movie actor, so he learned to, of course, deliver lines very well, but he spent years as the spokesman for General Electric, not only as the host of GE Theater, but going around to small towns, small cities, to Rotary clubs, speaking on behalf of GE. So he really got a sense from all that time on the road of what made Americans laugh or cry or respond in various ways. So he really, that was certainly a valuable skill for a politician to have. And
yes.
And I didn't know Reagan personally, but I've been in, rooms where he would be appearing to give speeches and talk to the press and so forth. And he was a person who had a great deal of magnetism about him. He was, I guess the phrase is, he'd fill the room. So he was certainly very skillful and in many ways a very intelligent man. In that he was able to put together a career in some very difficult areas. He was not only an actor, but he moved on to being someone who was spokesman for a major corporation, on to being governor of California, and then, of course, becoming a major political figure on the national scale. So he's certainly not someone to dismiss. I also tend to defend him from people who say that he wasn't really there, that because maybe early Alzheimer's had set in. And there certainly were times when Reagan would phase out when it came to the budget meetings, but on things he cared about, like some of these international affairs, what we now know sort of as the Iran-Contra period, he was very engaged. He wanted to know what the Contras were up to. They were something he cared a lot about, and he felt similarly about other aspects of foreign policy that did engage him.
We are talking about the legacy of Ronald Reagan as his 100th birthday is celebrated across this great land of ours, and you know, it seems to me that one of the difficulties of being president of these United States is that it's kind of two jobs. There's the head of state and head of government all rolled up into one. There are many places where you have two separate people. You know, a head of state could be, say, a monarch who represents the spirit of the country. And then you have some, you know, just government schlub who actually runs things. But here we have, it's very difficult. And the fact that somebody has been on camera in front of microphones is certainly a big plus. You have to be kind of have that star quality as well as running government. So I don't think there could be any debate that as an image, as a symbol, Ronald Reagan absolutely lifted our spirits. But it's important to also talk about what he really did, what his policies were, and here we are quite a while later, more than 30 years afterwards, and his effects we're still living with them. One of the things that he certainly talked about that Reagan is known for is believing in small government. And here's a quick cut, if this works, I think it will, about his belief in small government.
So as we begin, let us take inventory. We are a nation that has a government, not the other way around. And this makes us special among the nations of the earth. Our government has no power except that granted it by the people. It is time to check and reverse the growth of government, which shows signs of having grown beyond the consent of the governed. It is my intention to curb the size and influence of the federal establishment and to demand recognition of the distinction between the powers granted to the federal government and those reserved to the states or to the people.
That, of course, was from his first inaugural address back in 1980. Well, how did it go? Did he shrink the government? And was it, some have suggested that he wanted to shrink the government, but it was those pesky Democrats who didn't allow him to shrink the size of the federal government? Your comments, Robert Perry.
Well, I mean, obviously he didn't get everything he proposed. The Republicans did control the Senate. They won control of the Senate in 1980. They did not control the House of Representatives. So the Democrats did have that one part of the government. And so there were compromises. Also, back then, there was a lot more bipartisanship. That we had not yet gotten into the harshly partisan approach. The beginnings of that were already there. Newt Gingrich, who sort of came to personify much of that, had arrived in Congress in the late 70s and was already beginning to essentially sharpen the approach the Republicans would take with the goal of eroding and ultimately overturning their Democratic majority in the House, which happened in 1994. But you still had a lot of that old-time approach, which was much more working together, especially in the Senate. The Senate was much more bipartisan. The House was beginning to become more partisan. But so there were obviously compromises that had to be made. But I guess the bigger question I would have here is what Reagan, the way he tried to demonize government, was reflected in that comment. But the more remembered phrase from that first inaugural was when he said government is the problem, and that was an interesting approach, but one that has not really worked very well. If we look back now on 30 years. And I guess I start looking at some of this by looking at the so-called failed presidents of the 1970s, Nixon and Ford and then Carter. And even though they are not considered great presidents by most historians, they did begin grappling with some of the problems we were going to have to face as a nation, things like dealing with our energy dependence, things like addressing problems being dealt to the environment. And these were areas, as along with others, where Reagan came in and said, no, we don't have to worry about those things. We don't have to worry about alternative energy. There was a point where, so this is somewhat symbolic, but Jimmy Carter had put solar panels on the roof of the White House, and Reagan had them taken down. We weren't going to worry about that stuff. We were going to basically feel happy. And part of his lifting our spirit, as you put it, was that he essentially told the American people, you don't have to really work at those things. Don't feel guilty about buying that gas guzzler. And we're not going to let the government tell us what to do. Now, that certainly appeals to people. It's sort of like, you can get kids to go into a candy store pretty easily. But it ultimately left the United States still dependent 30 years later on foreign oil, even more dependent. Many of the environmental challenges have not been addressed, in part because Reagan kept blaming government for all the problems, and he put in people at the EPA and Interior who were hostile to any kind of effort to protect the environment, people like James Watt or Ann Gorsuch. So he took steps that were that may have been appealing to people who didn't want the government to sort of be intrusive. But there are times when the government's approaches toward regulation and things of that matter, or in terms of bringing together the kind of concentration of effort that government can do, that those things actually have helped the American people, from the space program, which spurred the growth of computers, Eisenhower's interstate highway system, which made the country much able to move goods much faster. Even going more recently to the birth of the Internet, which was actually a Defense Department project that has changed the shape of how Americans live and do business. So there are times when the government really has been helpful, and Reagan essentially chose to demonize it. And with that, he also chose to demonize regulations and things like the banking system and going into some areas of business. Those decisions had consequences. Just recently, the report came out on the financial crisis, and it makes reference to these problems have been developing for 30 years. Now, if you do the math, I can do that math. You subtract 30 years from today, and you're back at the beginning of Ronald Reagan's presidency, because he did not want government to be doing many of these things, which in fact government was doing reasonably well at the time. So his approach, since he also was not able to do all the things he may have wanted to, he may have wanted to do much more in terms of reigning in Social Security and Medicare, which he had opposed, if you remember.
Yes.
He wasn't able to achieve some of that, but the point is, his whole view that government was always the problem has had some very dangerous and harmful consequences now as we look 30 years past that.
We are talking to Robert Perry about an American legend riding high in the saddle, Ronald Reagan. What about the deregulation, you know, making government as the problem? And how did that affect our banking system? Right now it seems like the meltdown of 2009 was largely due to nobody was paying attention. Nobody was minding the store. The banks had been absolutely unleashed. Now, it's true, part of that blame has to go to President Bill Clinton for repealing the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated the lending institutions one from the other and gave kind of let them run free. But how did Reagan affect that? There was this term that many people have forgotten. A lot of people probably haven't even heard, Reaganomics. And the conventional wisdom is that President Reagan presided over an era of unmatched economic boom for all Americans. What is the reality on that?
Well, that really isn't true. In fact, early on in Reagan's presidency, there was a severe recession.
Yes.
What his major approach was what became known as supply-side economics, what his vice president had once referred to as voodoo economics, and that was that if you slash taxes and even if you increase military spending, which Reagan was claiming was necessary, that somehow that would pay for itself, and you would so the deficit, which was then about $35-40 billion, would evaporate. Instead, it went the other way. The red ink that the United States began spilling in its budget just grew into an ocean, and it also did not work that just because you slash taxes for the rich, this concept that money would then trickle down to the rest of us didn't turn out to work either. We began to see, although obviously anything can be traced back further, but you can get, when you start looking at the Reagan era, you start seeing this widening gap between the average American and the rich American. We became much more two societies. Whereas the America that came out of World War II and grew in the 50s and 60s was one where there was a very dynamic and powerful middle class,
right.
which then actually helped some of the wealthier people because Americans could buy
more
goods
stuff
from cars and refrigerators and so forth. And that began, the middle class began to stagnate and slide, whereas the upper end, because of the tax cuts that Reagan pushed through, began to open up a much larger gap from the rest of us. So you had this, so you ended up with an America that, where the economy wasn't working as well. There was also a period of deindustrialization that accelerated during this period. There was a great deal of decay in the American cities. And a lot of it goes back to the Reagan era, in part because he, in trying to shut down various government programs that might have addressed these problems, the problems got worse. The private sector did not step in the way he envisioned it would and solve these problems. You know, the private sector has its own agenda, which is to maximize profits for its shareholders.
So
to expect them to do much for the country,
right,
or for the broader society is not realistic. It turned out not to work.
Well, it seems like we're still having quite a bit of that now. Again, we're talking.
And by the way, in terms of the Glass-Steagall, while it's true that Clinton did sign it, that was pushed aggressively by the Republicans in Congress. He did agree to it, but I would not say that was something he was initiating. It was something that was passed during his presidency, but that was something that people like Phil Graham, senator from Texas, was very much involved with pushing.
The brilliant economist Phil Graham. Yeah. We're talking with Robert Perry about Ronald Reagan, and it does seem undebatable that Reagan's support largely came from what was then a larger middle class. There were the Reagan Democrats, the working class Democrats, the kind of Tip O'Neill Democrats that loved the guy. They really supported him. So how did Ronald Reagan, who everybody said was a nice guy, if he saw you had a problem, he'd do whatever he could to help you out personally. But how did his policies harm those people who are some of his biggest enthusiasts? In what specific ways did his policies kind of mess up what Thomas Jefferson said about the middle class is so essential to have any sort of democracy? You know, you see places like Egypt, for example, where there's a lot of people with no money and a few people with a tremendous amount of money, which has obviously gotten worse in the past 30 years or so. So what did Reagan do to really stick it to the middle class?
Well, there were a number of approaches, but in terms of some of those Reagan Democrats, many of them were union guys. Reagan went after the unions. He very famously broke the
PATCO
union, the air traffic controllers union. But it wasn't just that. He put in right wing ideologues into the National Labor Relations Board, so they would increasingly would side with companies against unions. You began seeing this dramatic decline in union membership during this period. There was also increased movement toward this global economy, which one obviously can't blame Reagan for that. He was it was something that was happening, but his approach is sort of his free market approach. Didn't do much in terms of trying to help Americans cope with it. As much as one can criticize someone like Bill Clinton, there was much more of an effort during the 90s to try to retrain American workers and get them so they could compete better in the modern economy. With this more of this laissez-faire free market approach, the American worker was kind of on his own.
Yeah.
And with the unions being weakened, with this broader decline in the middle class that we began to see, you had a general failure of those average working Americans to have the clout to negotiate better wages for themselves or to even to sustain their standing. So we began to see this gradual decline, this shedding of middle class jobs all across America. Some cities, especially places like Michigan, places where there were a lot of people who supported Reagan because they liked his style. They liked they thought Jimmy Carter was too much of a sourpuss. He was always trying to tell us what we needed to do, and here's Reagan basically saying, you know, America's great, we're number one, and don't worry about things.
Right.
So while that was appealing, it ended up that many of those cities began to decay. People talk about places like Detroit or Flint, Michigan, and others where, you know, obviously some of those problems go back further, but that the decay really becomes very noticeable during the 1980s.
And I think
we began to see people on the many more beggars on the street. I was in Washington, D.C., and I used to, and the AP office was downtown on K Street. And it was back in the 70s, you really didn't see beggars. You didn't see people sleeping in the doorways. During the Reagan era, that's when you first saw this. There were a lot of more panhandlers, a lot more people you have to sort of step over to get to the AP office. It was that was part of that era of being essentially cold-hearted toward people who needed things.
Right.
Also trying to shut down some of the mental hospitals and diverting money away from those kinds of public needs led to people being just thrown out onto the streets. So whether he was nice on a personal whether he was someone who might give you the shirt off his back is one thing, but when someone adopts policies that affect an entire nation, and some of those effects are to leave people in a great deal of pain and need, they're somewhat different. And for a politician, it's the latter part that one has to be concerned about, not the former, because the number of people they actually touch personally compared to the numbers that they can affect with their policies isn't comparable. And you expect politicians to be nice guys. Most politicians I know are very nice personally.
Right.
It doesn't mean they're nice
policies,
depending on how you view it, with terms of what they do for the country or to the country. But it is. But most of them are rather gregarious.
You have to be.
It doesn't mean they're good. they're good policymakers.
So a rising tide did not, in fact, lift all boats, as a lot of people still seem to mythologize about the 80s and the Reagan era. And it seemed like the political sway shifted from what had been a very strong, politically powerful middle class. It shifted to a very few people with a tremendous amount of money. And that's who the government started working for, as opposed to the common good. And here's kind of a telling quote from Ronald Reagan about, you know, his care about poorer people in the United States. Let's give a listen.
What can we do about this? Well, you and I can do a great deal. We can write to our congressmen, to our senators. We can say right now that we want no further encroachment on these individual liberties and freedoms. And at the moment, the key issue is we do not want socialized medicine.
We do not want socialized medicine. That was from 1963. Ronald Reagan, he took office when there had been, under President Lyndon Johnson and others, a war on poverty. And I remember some buttons going around at the time, stop Reagan's war on the poor. So he transformed the war on poverty into a war on the poor. Was the conventional wisdom at the time seemed to be that the war on poverty was a failure, and that the best thing to do was turn the corporations loose, have very few restrictions and regulations, and that would be much better for the economy. So was the war on poverty a failure after all? Was this a better approach in this, you know, calling Medicare? He was against Medicare. That's what he was talking about in that quote. Socialism, Medicare, you know, helping people be healthy. How successful was the war on poverty?
Well, I think one has to look at different parts of it. Some parts were famously not very successful, but other parts achieved a great deal. Americans were faced back before Medicare. This is, you know, back early in my years too. But the back before then, if you had an elderly parent who needed medical attention and couldn't afford it, sometimes it could bankrupt entire families,
right,
or leave them with these horrible choices of allowing a parent or a grandparent to pass away without getting the proper attention. Medicare wasn't a way to address that. Much as Social Security was a way from the New Deal to address the horrible poverty that elderly people faced when they could no longer work and were essentially shunted aside by a society that even then was very much oriented toward business. That was, of course, going in before the New Deal, you had a kind of a laissez-faire economic system where the government did not provide much help. The New Deal provided Social Security to give elderly people some modicum of support when they were in their retired period. Then, of course, Medicare was an effort to make sure that they got the medical attention they needed. Not that maybe all the attention wasn't the best of medicine, perhaps, but it was a minimal basis for people getting attended to. So Reagan was against that sort of thing. He wanted to go back to that period of before the New Deal, before the Great Society, with the idea that people should just spend for themselves.
Yeah.
And that didn't really, as we've now seen 30 years into this experiment, and the experiment has pretty much continued. There have been moments, perhaps in the 90s, where Clinton tried to humanize it a bit, but he still went along with much of it. And the Republicans have been in charge of Congress for much of this period, too. So what you've ended up with is this experiment of what happens to a society when you start carving away these kinds of protections, whether they're the union protections for people's jobs or an effort for the country to not ship its factories overseas. If you give corporations all the power, they will do what's in their interest or the interest of their shareholders. That's what their fiduciary responsibility is. That's what a CEO is supposed to do, maximize the profits for the people who own the company. He can argue that it's even a moral responsibility as well as a legal one to do that. So if that means sending the factory to India, that's what they do. They don't have to care about the American people. They're not patriotic in that sense.
No.
So if you have a government that says, well, that's okay, you know, government is the problem. We want to get rid of the government. And that's sort of the Reagan approach, which has been carried forward by many of the Republicans who've embraced Reaganomics and Reaganism. Then you end up with a lot of the people who are not rich and powerful themselves, but who could be very productive members of society, ending up being unemployed or underemployed. You end up with the factories being shuttered and shipped abroad. Those are the kinds of things that happen if you don't have a government that is sort of acting as a counterweight to these all-powerful corporations. And that's sort of the fatal flaw, the Achilles heel of Reaganism, the assumption that just by telling the corporations to do whatever they want, that they'll somehow self-regulate, they'll somehow act in the best interest of the nation. They won't.
Right.
And we've certainly, that's been this 30-year experiment called Reaganism. We should now be looking back at that and saying, well, what did we get from it? Are we better off today than we were 30 years ago, to sort of paraphrase Ronald Reagan? I think most Americans would look and say, not really. I mean, some may have done okay, but a lot haven't. And generally speaking, America still has the problems that we were trying to address in the 70s. We're still importing oil from the Middle East at massive amounts. We have actually made things a lot worse. We in the sense that the tax cuts have left us with massive deficits. And that was something that we did not have back in the 70s. We had deficits we thought were large back then, but they were minuscule compared to what we have today. You know, instead of 40 billion or so, we now have 1.5 trillion.
And that's one question, you know, the images of Reagan as a conservative, both an economic conservative and kind of a conservative culture warrior. And looking at the fiscal policies, he didn't shrink government. What happened to the budget deficit? He wanted to, you know, in the part of helping out the corporations fix everything, At least you would make government smaller and control federal spending. That would be the plus side. But what actually happened to federal spending, to the deficit at the time, the national debt, for example, and, you know, his deficits? Was he a fiscal conservative?
Oh, no. I mean, there's no question that the deficits that we began to see in the 1980s and going into the early 1990s under his successor, George H.W. Bush, were astronomical by all comparisons. I covered the budget for the AP back in the late 70s on Capitol Hill, so I was involved very much in following that, and the budget was almost in balance there for a while. And both sides, Republican and Democrat, worked very cooperatively to try to make sure that any tax increases were well targeted and tax cuts were going to bring some kind of bang for the buck for the country. They didn't do massive carving away of the tax system. They tried to make things work, and in a pretty practical way. When Reagan came in, then came the just massive across the board tax cuts, heavily tilted to the wealthy, and with this idea that was this grand experiment that was going to somehow pay for itself and get rid of that $40 billion deficit. It didn't work that way. So on top of it, Reagan was insistent upon massive new military spending. And this gets to my bigger point. Actually, my main concern about Reagan is more his on his the foreign policy side.
Well, I'd
like
to get there,
yes. In terms of the presidency in that regard. And part of that was he insisted, and this goes back even to the mid-70s when he was first stepping onto the national stage. He ran in 76 for the Republican nomination and scared the bejesus out of Gerald Ford.
Indeed.
And what he wanted to do there was he was insisting that instead of the Cold War winding down, which was the way the CIA analytical division was seeing it, and the way people like Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger were acting, they were talking about détente with the Soviets, because the Soviets were clearly falling way behind in terms of technological development and other key areas. So the Soviets were beginning to sort of sue for peace, if you will, trying to engage with the West. Mm-hmm. Have negotiations. So that was what we call détente. Reagan insisted, and he had the support of some hardline Cold Warriors and a new group of people called neoconservatives that were just beginning to form back then.
Yes.
And they insisted the opposite. They said, no, the Soviet Union is on the march. They've developed secret weapons, so secret that the CIA can't even detect them, that they're about to take over the world. And we have to have a massive military buildup to close what they call the window of vulnerability. We now know that was all imaginary. There were no secret weapons that the Soviets had developed. Their technology was really way behind ours and the West. And the Soviets had recognized that, and the CIA recognized that because our spies were telling us that from inside the Kremlin. And as well as other points of observation that the analytical division was assessing. Reagan reversed it. He basically, his great power, his great success in a way, was to change reality. He figured out through various means how you could sort of create a false reality for the American people and make them more scared about things and say that they exaggerate the threats. And in doing so, he convinced Americans to support a massive military buildup against an enemy that was in rapid decline. That's also a factor in the budget. When he came in, he insisted on this essentially a major reinvestment in military hardware and development, along with his tax cuts. None of this added up.
Right.
And so it left the United States with this huge military industrial complex, much bigger than we'd ever had, and without the tax system to support it. And the consequences were devastating in terms of the budget. And there were no way to bring about the kinds of domestic spending cuts, even though he pushed for many of them,
right,
that would have been necessary to cover the shortfall.
Yeah, it's simple economics. If you have less money coming in via tax cuts, and you spend a heck of a lot more on military hardware that doesn't build up the economy, really, except for the military contractors, guess what? You get a big, big deficit. But it's interesting what you're saying about he created a different reality. People just wanted to see. And, you know, one thing that the people now believe, there's this myth about Reagan, quite a few myths, actually, that Reagan won the Cold War. He told Gorbachev to tear down this wall, and behold, it came tumbling down. Did it, you know, he was a hawk, really built up the military. Did this approach not successfully end the Cold War? Did his military buildup actually move the process forward and help with the final demise of the Soviet Union?
Well, not really. No, I mean, obviously anyone, there are different historians who will give you different takes on this, but basically the Cold War was considered over by the early to mid-1970s. That was the whole point of détente. It's why Nixon and Kissinger and then Ford were pursuing those kinds of negotiations with the Soviets. So the Soviets had been defeated, really. Their economic model had been a disaster. They couldn't meet their consumer needs. They couldn't stay up. They were falling farther and farther behind in terms of technology, which was a particularly dangerous thing for them, because the technology would sort of grow on itself. It became exponential. Computers got better and better. The Soviets were still using abacuses in Moscow. So the Soviets needed to strike a deal, and they were, even though there were hot spots that broke out here and there, they really weren't on this sort of march to take over the planet. They could barely keep control of themselves in their own backyard. So that was the reality. That's what the CIA saw. That's what the best spies the U.S. had inside the Kremlin were telling the CIA.
Yeah.
Reagan didn't want to believe that. For whatever his reasons, the right wing in the United States wanted to build up the military. They wanted to be more aggressive around the world. They were supporting many of these very vicious regimes, like the Argentine
dictator,
dirty war government.
Yep.
Death squads were being set up in many of these little countries in Central America to go kill anyone who got in the way. And that's what Reagan said was necessary. Now, when you get to 1987, when he gives his speech, it was early March, April of 1987, where he gives his speech, where he says, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." The wall didn't get torn down. The Berlin Wall doesn't come down until November of 89.
Right.
More than 2 years later, after Reagan's out of office, and by the way, Mr. Gorbachev didn't tear it down.
That's true.
It was torn down by the German people, first with sledgehammers, and later they brought in some earth-moving equipment. You know, so it wasn't like, I mean, I know we see these things now, the way it's set up for our viewing pleasure these days, is you have Reagan making this statement,
and then the next frame
is
right.
The wall coming down. But that's just like trick photography. You put two things together that don't really connect.
I was just going to, you know, here we are in an age where, you know, we're fighting terrorists around the world, and Reagan actually had a lot to do with that, as far as I understand. You know, there was this proxy war with the Soviet Union. Reagan was training, arming, equipping, and funding Islamic Mujahideen fighters in Afghanistan. He funneled billions of dollars, along with top secret intelligence and sophisticated weaponry, to these fighters fighting the proxy war to weaken the Soviet Union. You know, Afghanistan was then called the Soviet Union's Vietnam. It dragged him down. Now, here we are. It appears that we're fighting some of these same people. Now, how did Reagan contribute to creating the Taliban and even Osama bin Laden?
Well, the core problem with this is this issue of politicizing the CIA, which was that the CIA's job, going back to when it was founded by Harry Truman, was to provide the president with unvarnished intelligence, real information, because the concern obviously had been no more Pearl Harbors. So, and despite the CIA's troubles maybe on the operational side, where they'd get involved in trying to overthrow governments, but the other side, the analytical side, tried to do its job pretty honestly. Made mistakes sometimes, but was basically trying to do its job objectively, professionally. Sure. That changed under Reagan. Reagan did not want that anymore. He wanted to have the Soviet Union 10 feet tall, about to take over the world, attack us through Texas, et cetera, et cetera. The CIA saw something else. So he had to, so when he took over in 81, there was a real assault on the CIA's analytical division. And many of the old criminologists who actually were getting it right were kicked out. So they kept putting in people who would exaggerate the Soviet menace. That justified then some of looking at things like the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan in a much more dangerous way than it actually was. It was really more of a defensive action on the part of the Soviets, which the Soviet Union bordered on Afghanistan.
Right.
And there was a pro-Soviet government in charge, which had, despite you know the fact it was sort of semi-communist and for all those negatives, but it was trying to break down this feudal system in Afghanistan. It was trying to, it allowed women to dress as they chose. It allowed women to go to school. It was against that kind of medieval Islamic approach. And that, of course, angered some of the traditionalists in Afghanistan who were very hardline Islamists. The United States, because of having exaggerated the threat from the Soviet Union, then decided that it had to support the Islamicization of the region. So the CIA it was printing Bibles to give to Eastern Europe, but it also was printing Korans to try to smuggle them into the southern part of the Soviet Union, what we now call the Stan countries, which were heavily Islamic. The U.S. was trying to use Islam as a counterforce to what was considered the atheistic communists. If you get people to right. believe in religion, they would then oppose the communist system.
Right.
So that was the thinking. Now, to do that, there had to be a number of other compromises made. So the United States began to arm these hardline Islamists in Afghanistan. The United States helped bring in support from Saudi Arabia, which included them helpfully sending us people like Osama bin Laden and people that became part of what we now call al-Qaeda, who went to Afghanistan to help in this jihad against the Soviets. And they were getting help from the Americans. The United States also had to deal with the Pakistanis. Now, the Pakistanis were willing to pass on the weapons to Osama bin Laden and to these Islamists, but they wanted something in return. They wanted the Reagan administration to turn a blind eye to their development of a nuclear bomb, which Reagan also agreed to do. And so some of the poor guys over at CIA, who were the analysts saying, hold it, you know, the Pakistanis are building a nuclear bomb, they got fired too. They were basically, anyone who was telling the truth about some of these things that went against what Reagan wanted to hear were getting cashiered. And so the United States basically enabled the Pakistanis to develop their nuclear arsenal as part of the price for the Pakistanis passing on U.S. weapons to the Mujahideen and to Osama bin Laden and his guys.
Mm.
And it sounds crazy today, perhaps, but that was the policy.
That's what happened. That is what happened.
And so we ended up with a much more dangerous situation. First of all, the Soviet situation was probably was being the danger there was being exaggerated. They already were in an advanced stage of collapse.
Yeah.
And the United States ended up fueling this Islamic fanaticism. Including helping bin Laden sort of get his people together in Afghanistan. And the Pakistanis were able to get a nuclear arsenal, which now numbers about 100 nuclear bombs, which is probably the biggest
Whoa.
Security threat in the world today.
Wow.
I think people from the right and left would agree with this, that perhaps the biggest national security threat is the Pakistani nuclear arsenal, and that the chances it might fall into the wrong hands.
Well, he made
so
us.
A lot of that goes back to very misguided, short-sighted policies that Ronald Reagan and his team followed in the 1980s.
Again, the alternative reality that he imposed on the real reality. We are talking on the Burt Cohen Show with Robert Perry, an investigative journalist.
Consortiumnews.com.
Consortiumnews.com, if you want to follow his stuff. And before we get to Iran-Contra, Beirut. What was the message to terrorists in Beirut? People forget about those 241 American Marines who were killed basically without defense. And what kind of a message did Reagan's policy give to the people who did that?
Well, the problem with the Middle East is that if you come out also out of this, the late 70s, remember Jimmy Carter was pressing the Israelis and some of the Arab countries to achieve peace. He pushed through the Camp David Accords in 78,
right,
where Israel agreed to give back the Sinai to the Egyptians in exchange for a peace treaty.
Yes.
A peace treaty which has held, really, for the last 30-plus years.
Yes.
The Likud party, which was in power in Israel, didn't like that. Prime Minister Begin went along with it, but he was very unhappy, and he was very fearful that a second Jimmy Carter term would have opened the door to a Palestinian state, which at that time Likud really didn't want. They wanted to expand into the West Bank. They did not want to have a Palestinian state. So some of the Israelis basically threw their lot in with the Reagan campaign going back to 1980. They provided various kinds of support and in terms of trying to get to see that Reagan got in and Carter got, more importantly, that Carter got out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so Reagan and his people had this relationship with the Israelis that predated their election, and it basically allowed the Israelis to be much more freewheeling in terms of how they would deal with some of these problems, including this invasion of Lebanon, which Reagan didn't really support, but he didn't really initially stop. And so the Israelis overreached. They went in. The thought was they'd just take some of the southern territory in Lebanon where they were getting harassed with missiles and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But they went further. They went all the way to Beirut, and they tried to drive the PLO out. And that got the Israelis into a bigger mess than they had expected. That also then led the United States to commit peacekeepers, the Marines,
right,
to try to keep the two sides apart. However, in the midst of this, some of the Reagan people in the Reagan administration, especially Robert McFarlane, who was then on the National Security Council staff, pushed for the U.S. to start shelling some of these Arab villages, and that sort of got the U.S. much more involved than was intended initially. So these kinds of things sort of spiraled out of control. There were cases where what you might call mission creep was occurring. And so once the U.S. had sort of taken sides in the conflict, that opened up the Marines to counterattack.
Yes.
And there was not adequate safeguard. They were essentially sitting ducks.
Yes.
And a suicide bomber with a truck full of explosives crashed through and blew up their building, and 241 of them died.
Yes.
So then at that point, Reagan then withdrew the U.S. forces offshore. And in other words, he got the U.S. Sort of rather foolishly involved in a civil war, and then withdrew the American troops, which was kind of a signal to the terrorists, I think the point you're making, that this was a way you could get your way with the United States. There were counter-terror and terror activities. The U.S. was involved with some terrorist activities themselves. CIA Director Casey has been implicated in one of the in a car bombing that was aimed at one of the Hezbollah leaders. It got pretty messy.
Wow.
And eventually some of that chaos with the hostage takings and these various tit for tat violent attacks set the stage for what we now know as Iran-Contra, which was an effort by Reagan secretly and against the law to provide weapons to the Iranians in exchange for their supposed help in getting some U.S. hostages freed from Lebanon. And again, we get back to the question of Reagan's honesty, and as a point I think that's very important, his ability to twist the truth or ignore it. He agreed to some of the laws that said, for instance, the U.S. could not provide weapons to Iran, which was then designated a terrorist state.
Right.
Because that would require notifying Congress under the Arms Export Control Act. He didn't want to tell Congress because there would have been a firestorm if people knew that we were arming the Iranians. But so he just went ahead and did it secretly outside the law. and using essentially extra-constitutional means. He did the same in Central America when Congress forbade military support to the Nicaraguan Contras, but Reagan signed the law and then went ahead and violated it. He had Oliver North arrange for weapons to be shipped to the Contras in this sort of sub rosa system. And really what we're seeing was the reassertion of the imperial presidency, which had been in eclipse since Vietnam, and there have been efforts by Congress to rein in the idea that the president could do whatever he wanted in terms of warfare and foreign policy. And those things had been put in the 70s. Reagan didn't like them, and he essentially just ignored them with these various means that he set up. So you had the beginnings of what we saw coming to fruition under George W. Bush, this idea that the president could do whatever he wanted again.
So
Reagan really put the country back on that course as well, that that Congress could be swept aside, that the Constitution, in terms of its limitations on presidential power, didn't mean anything. That once you could, if you could say, Clay, that if you could say there was some kind of war going on, a Cold War or a war on terror or whatever, that the president could then do whatever he wanted. This was a major reversal from what was going on in the 70s. And has really continued to this day.
I find it so fascinating. A lot of the Tea Party people today who just absolutely idolize Ronald Reagan and swear by the Constitution. You have to stick by the Constitution. What Reagan did was so incredibly anti-Constitution. Some people said what he did may have been felonious and even treasonous because he so clearly broke the law. And you just...
He also lied about it. When he was caught, he lied. He said... both in the terms of what happened in Central America. If you remember, there was in October of 1986, one of the supply planes was shot down, and Reagan personally denied that there was any U.S. government connection to the flight. Then a month or so later, there was a disclosure about the weapon sales to Iran. Again, Reagan denounced the story and said it was untrue. In both cases, he lied. And he was caught lying, and he eventually sort of acknowledged that, oh, yes, he misspoke or got it wrong. But it's pretty clear that he knew what was going on, and just he felt he could control reality, or somehow he felt reality wasn't what many of us consider important. They were simply things to manipulate to get various kinds of emotional reactions from the American people.
And maybe
he had maybe an actor's view of reality.
Right, that's what I was thinking, that maybe his acting background and skills were perfect for that because it's just a stage. You know, whatever the reality is you project, that's the reality. But we are paying the price for that now. Now, are there any, why is nobody speaking up and telling the truth about this American icon right now? Are Democrats so cowed into this that they just don't...
Well, I was around, I went to Newsweek in the late 80s and had a lot of fights there because I thought we should continue on and get to the bottom of some of these scandals. And the feeling inside Newsweek and other major news outlets was, let's leave those for the historians. But there was a careerism that was also part of what was going on in Washington during that time. Journalism was changing. It was kind of a winner take all thing. There were fewer jobs, but some of those jobs paid very, very well. So reporters didn't want to really become too controversial. Let's say there was a phrase that the Reagan people liked to use. They would controversialize you as a journalist if you wrote stories they didn't like, which meant they would get their friends to attack you, and they'd put pressure on your editors, and they had a whole system set up, often using people we now call the neocons to head this. They were very smart at this and very clever. So there was a lot of intimidation going on during that period, especially for people who...
What about now?
Well, things haven't changed all that much, but I think at that time you had this, it was sort of a new wave of going after journalists, going after people in government who were... people in the CIA even, who were trying to tell the truth, to shut them up and intimidate them. So by the time you get to the end of that Reagan-Bush 1 era, there's sort of an exhaustion and a lot of fear. So when Clinton wins, finally in late 92 and takes office in 93, there's a chance to sort of open this up and deal with this and sort of explain to the American people what had happened. But that was going to be hard. It was going to require a lot of conflict. The Republicans were digging in. They were fighting already for Reagan's legacy. And so Clinton and his people, essentially, and the Democrats in general, chose to finesse it. They said, well, that's not that important. We have a lot of difficulties facing the country. We don't want to have these bitter fights about some what happened in the past decade. We have to look to the future. Remember, Bill Clinton ran on this idea that all politics is about the future, and his theme song was Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow.
Right.
So he didn't want to deal with the past, and it would have been hard, no question. And I at that time, I talked to people like John Podesta and George Stephanopoulos, who were in the White House, and I'd say, why aren't you guys providing some help in terms of getting the facts out about the many scandals? The U.S. also was secretly supporting Saddam Hussein at the, back then, if you remember.
Oh, yes.
As well as the Iranians, as well as the Iran-Contra business and related scandals. And they basically just said it wasn't something they cared about, and they weren't going to go there. So the history was then, so there was a decision not to pursue the history. And then in 94, when the Republicans came back very quickly, very aggressively, and began creating scandals about Clinton, and then won control of the Congress, they made a very smart decision on their part. They decided they would turn Reagan into an icon. They would start naming buildings after him and making him sort of untouchable historically.
Mm-hmm.
He was going to be their John F. Kennedy. You know, they're Martin Luther King.
Wow.
And the Democrats, again, didn't see the danger to this. Bill Clinton's, you know, signed some of these bills that named things after Reagan. He thought that was a small price to pay for some bipartisanship.
Mm. But the effects that it's...
The trouble was that once you established Reaganism as sort of this untouchable, unchallengeable approach... That had future connotations as well as historical connotations, and it allowed people to sort of embrace this idea that government is the problem, and that's now really a fundamental aspect of the Republican Party and the Tea Party. So the Democrats were kind of foolish, in my view. They were cowardly and foolish. They didn't have the guts to really demand the truth, and they didn't have the wisdom to understand the consequences of allowing Reagan to become an icon.
And we...
So that's the situation we find ourselves in today. Reagan is this icon, and if you watch some of the liberal commentators, someone like a Chris Matthews, for instance, falling over himself to try to find reasons to praise Reagan and declare that he's one of the all-time great presidents. I mean, this really says more about the careerism of Washington than it does about the real history of Ronald Reagan.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, lack of courage always seems to pay off. Well, we've been talking with Robert Perry, who was there in the Reagan era as an investigative reporter. Thank you so much for being with us. His most recent book is Neck Deep, The Disastrous Presidency of George W. Bush, and ConsortiumNews.com. Is that right?
That's right.
ConsortiumNews.com. Thanks so much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show. We could easily spend another hour talking about more things that the real Ronald Reagan did. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Burt.
Thank you.